Imagine the scenario for a second. It is 11:47 p.m. on a rainy Tuesday in Portland.
A very specific time.
Right. And you are a tired material science professor at Portland State. You're wearing a flannel shirt that has definitely seen better days. Your coffee is completely cold. And you are running your 47th batch of a totally routine experiment.
Batch 47C, to be exact.
Exactly. So you turn a dial to apply just a little bit of electrical current to a thin film of copper-doped molybdenum disulfide. And then suddenly the sample doesn't just get hot.
No, it definitely
It
doesn't.
shoots across the table, it cracks the tempered glass of your fume hood, flies across the room, and embeds itself literally like a throwing knife straight into the drywall.
And just like that, the world has changed. Because in that split second, you haven't just broken a fume hood, you have potentially broken the laws of physics as we understand them.
Today, we are doing a deep dive into the story of the Skylark Threshold. We're talking about the S film, the race to orbit, and how a random supplier error at a copper factory kicked off what is probably the most dangerous engineering project in human history.
It really is a fascinating case study in serendipity, physics, and high-stakes industrial espionage. We have access to the journals, the logs, and the raw data from Dr. Nate Seaton's lab. And what we're looking at here is effectively the invention of the reactionless drive.
Okay, let's unpack that term, reactionless drive, for a second, because I think my high school physics teacher would be screaming right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Newton's third law, right? For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Rockets work by throwing fire out the back to push the ship forward. If this thing has no exhaust, aren't we just violating the laws of the universe?
That is exactly what Dr. Seaton thought at first. I mean, he assumed he had blown a capacitor or there was some magnetic interaction he just missed.
Sure, human error.
Right. But strictly speaking, it is not violating Newton's laws. It actually is pushing against something. It's just pushing against something we usually think of as empty.
The vacuum.
Yes, the quantum vacuum. But before we get to the how of it all, we really have to talk about the happy accident. Because Nate Seaton was not trying to build a spaceship.
Not at all.
He was researching thermoelectrics. He was basically trying to make better heat sensors. So he ordered some copper targets for his sputtering chamber.
Quick pause there. For those of you who haven't spent time in a materials lab, a sputtering chamber is basically an atomic spray painter, right?
That is a great way to describe it. You use plasma to blast a block of metal, and it coats your sample in a perfectly thin layer. So Nate orders this copper, but the supplier messed up.
And this is the crux of the whole thing.
It is. Usually, copper is a mix of two isotopes, copper 63 and copper 65. It's a natural blend you find everywhere. But this batch, it was exactly 72.8% copper 63 and 27.2% copper 65.
That is an oddly specific number.
Very specific. And that tiny, seemingly insignificant difference in atomic weight changed the crystal structure just enough to do something completely impossible.
So, Nate, who the sources describe as this real grinder of a scientist, you know, the guy who is always in the lab late at night, he sees this film punch a hole in his wall. He doesn't call the press, he
No.
doesn't call the Pentagon. What does he actually do?
He measures it. And honestly, this is why I love this story. It's not about some cinematic flash of inspiration. It is about grinding out the data. He builds a pendulum rig inside a vacuum jar.
Trying to rule out air currents.
Exactly. He thinks, okay, maybe it was a fluke. He turns on the current, and clang, the pendulum slams against the side of the jar.
It wasn't a fluke.
No, it was real. And the data was impossible. The force was linear to the current. You put more juice in, you get more push out. And importantly, the force was always perpendicular to the surface of the film.
Meaning it didn't matter which way gravity was pulling.
Right. The film pushed up relative to itself, always normal to the surface. And there was no exhaust, no radiation, no heat signature initially.
And the numbers. We aren't talking about a tiny little microscopic nudge here, are we?
No, we are not. He calculated that if you scale this thin film up to a square meter, you're looking at 40 kilonewtons of thrust.
Wow.
To put that in perspective for you, this film beats a standard ion engine, which is the current state of the art for efficient space travel, by a factor of 1,000 in thrust to power ratio.
1,000.
Yes, it is like comparing a bicycle to a Ferrari.
Okay, so he has the what, but he doesn't have the why. He knows it works, but not how. Enter the theorist, Dr. Anya Patel.
Right. Nate calls her in to make sense of this absolute madness. And she's the one who connects to the Casimir effect.
Now, I know the Casimir effect has something to do with metal plates in a vacuum, but break that down for us. How does a piece of copper push off of literally nothing?
Well, think of the quantum vacuum not as empty space, but as a roaring ocean of virtual particles just constantly popping in and out of existence. Usually that pressure is equal on all sides of an object, so it just cancels out. You don't feel it. But Anya postulates that this specific isotope ratio creates a broken symmetry.
A broken symmetry. Give me an analogy for that.
Imagine a guitar string. If a guitar string is loose, the wind just blows past it. It doesn't make a sound. It doesn't really catch the wind at all. But if you tighten that string to the exact right tension,
it resonates.
Exactly. It hums. The copper lattice in this film, because of that 72.8% ratio, is tuned to the frequency of the vacuum fluctuations.
So it's interacting with particles that barely exist.
Yes, it creates a phonon mode, a physical vibration within the material that resonates with those virtual photon pairs in the vacuum. It catches the vacuum the way a sail catches the wind. It's a one-way gate for momentum.
So instead of carrying heavy rocket fuel, you are literally sailing on the fabric of space-time itself.
Precisely. And once you realize you can sail, you realize you can go absolutely anywhere. And this is where the story shifts from a quirky science mystery to a full-blown engineering race.
Because Nate calls his old friend Martin Crane. And I really love the dynamic here. Nate is the academic in the flannel shirt. Martin is the battery entrepreneur who made a fortune, drives a Rivian, and has that classic move fast and break things operational mindset.
Martin is the catalyst. He sees the pendulum data, does some back of the envelope math on a napkin in a diner, and realizes we can build a spaceship.
Today.
Right. But he also knows the harsh reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot build a reactionless drive at a public university.
It's too dangerous.
And too valuable. So they go underground, literally and figuratively. They secure a decommissioned Air National Guard hangar. And they start building a team.
And the team is crucial. They bring in Vanessa Almeida, Nate's postdoc. She is basically the only person on Earth who actually knows the recipe for making these films reliably.
Yes, her role becomes massive later on. And then crucially, they bring in Dorothy Vanman.
Dorothy is arguably my favorite figure in this whole saga. She's the JPL veteran. She has put rovers on Mars. She walks into this hangar, looks at their magic copper film, and she doesn't share.
No, she gets scared. She is the voice of cold, hard engineering reality. She tells them the thermal management problem is going to eat you alive.
Because of the heat.
Exactly. The physics says you get thrust, but thermodynamics says you also get heat. Massive amounts of it. And in space, there is no air to cool you down by convection. You can't just open a window or use a fan.
So this dictates the entire design of their ship, the Skylark. And we should be clear, this is not a sleek sci-fi fighter jet.
Far from it. Picture a 12-meter-long aluminum lithium soda can. Strapped to the back is a nuclear reactor.
An IMSR reactor, right?
Right. Because you need massive electrical current to run the films.
Yeah.
And sticking out of the sides of this can are these huge, ugly sodium heat pipe radiators.
The source documents describe them as looking like the petals of an angular flower.
It is a very industrial, purely functional aesthetic. It has no escape system. It has no seats. It is a machine built for one single thing, to prove it can be done.
And they are trying to go from a lab bench anomaly to a crewed orbital flight in 3 months.
Which is an insane timeline.
Yeah.
But they have to move that fast because they aren't the only ones who know about the anomaly anymore.
And this is where the thriller element really kicks in. Enter Vanguard Strategic.
The antagonist of our story.
Right. Vanguard is the 800-pound gorilla of defense contracting. We are talking black budgets, private intelligence, and a serious lack of moral qualms. Russell Brookings is running the show over there.
And they have their own physicist, Dr. Mark Duquesne. He is fascinating because he is the dark mirror of Nate. He's just as brilliant, just as capable, but he is completely willing to work within the corporate defense machine.
Vanguard's cyber team manages to exfiltrate Nate's data from the university servers before Nate goes dark. They steal the thrust measurements.
But there's a catch, and this is such a great historical detail. They got the data files, but they didn't get the notebook.
Because Nate is old school.
Exactly. Nate wrote the specific isotope ratio, that 72.8 to 27.2 split, in a physical Moleskin notebook. He never put it on the computer.
So Duquesne sees the thrust measurements, he sees the impossible data, but when he tries to replicate it in the lab, it fails. He gets these ghosts in his data, just stuttering thrust.
He doesn't have the key ingredient. And that sets up this incredible cat and mouse game. You have Duquesne trying to brute force the physics at Vanguard's Groom Lake facility, while simultaneously, Vanguard's intelligence wing is physically surveilling Nate's team.
Trying to steal the missing piece, the escalation is terrifying. They break into Nate's old lab. The sources note a specific scratch on the strike plate of the door.
They plant malware on a USB drive at Martin's battery company to bridge the air gap on their secure network. They are relentless.
And eventually, through sheer computational power and espionage, Duquesne figures it out. He solves the isotope problem.
So now the race is real. There are two ships being built simultaneously.
Right. Nate and Martin are building Skylark in a hangar in Portland with a skeleton crew. Vanguard is building their ship, the Condor, in Nevada with basically unlimited funding. Let's compare the two. If Skylark is a stripped-down drag racer, what is Condor?
Condor is a battleship. It is 140 tons compared to Skylark's 20 tons. It has a heavily armored hull. And perhaps most disturbingly to everyone involved, it has a kinetic railgun spine running down the center.
Vanguard isn't building an explorer. They're building a weapon to secure low Earth orbit.
But Duquesne is worried about it. He actually understands the physics better than his corporate bosses do. He knows that mass requires power. To move that heavy armor and that massive railgun, they have to run the S-films hotter, much hotter.
Which brings us back to Dorothy's warning, the thermal management problem.
Precisely. The Condor is faster, and it's much stronger, but it has a fatal flaw in its thermal duty cycle. It cannot sustain thrust as long as the Skylark without literally melting its own radiators.
It's the classic tortoise and hare dynamic, only the hare is carrying a machine gun and is currently on fire.
That's a good way to put it. But before either of them can launch, Nate's team hits a wall. A literal wall in their supply chain. The copper crisis.
Right, because you can't just go to a hardware store and buy isotope-enriched copper.
No. There are only two places in North America to get it in the quantities they need. Oak Ridge National Lab and a tiny little startup in British Columbia. Nate places an order at Oak Ridge for the fuel they need, and suddenly the status of the order changes to under review.
Vanguard pulled the strings.
It completely blockaded the supply, and this is where the project really should have died. They have the ship, they have the nuclear reactor integrated, but they don't have the film to make it fly.
But this is where the scrappy MacGyver spirit of Nate's team really shines. Vanessa Almeida steps up. What does she do? Because they can't get the 72.8% enrichment anymore.
She tweaks the actual manufacturing process. She discovers that if she changes the temperature of the substrate, basically heating the glass that the film sits on during the sputtering process, she can alter how the crystal grows.
A temperature compensation.
Yes. She figures out a way to use lower grade enrichment, just 71%, which they can still get from that Canadian startup.
But there's a trade-off, right? It's not as powerful.
They get about 60% of the original thrust. But, and this is the crucial discovery, the films last much longer. Because they aren't vibrating quite as violently, the material doesn't degrade as fast. So they sacrifice raw power for endurance.
It really highlights the stark difference between the two teams. Vanguard has unlimited black budget resources, so they just brute force the perfect solution. Nate's team is sleeping on cots, formatting USBs to dodge malware, and hacking their own equipment to make it work.
It creates a very distinct culture. On one side, you have a committee-designed weapon system. On the other, a survival machine built by four people who trust each other implicitly.
So the clock is ticking, they are weeks away from launch, and then the phone rings. Nate gets a call.
Stop building. This is your only warning.
Chilling. Just a voice on the line. And immediately following that threat, a visitor arrives at the Portland hangar, Major General Whitfield.
This is a massive pivotal moment in the timeline. Mm-hmm. The government finally steps out of the shadows. General Whitfield walks in, looks at the Skylark, and she validates them. She says, I know the physics is real.
But she gives them a choice. And it's a really tough one.
She offers them the protection of the Air Force Research Lab. Funding, security, armed guards. But the cost is total control. The project becomes a special access program, a SCIF.
It goes completely dark.
It becomes a state secret. You don't own it anymore.
Nate and Martin say no, which takes some serious nerve when a major general is standing in your workspace offering you an out.
It does. They choose the risk of the open world over the safety of the vault. But Nate realizes something important. He knows they cannot win a physical fight against Vanguard. Condor has a railgun. Skylark has zero weapons. And they can't win a legal fight against the government if they try to keep it a secret.
So Nate pulls the ultimate academic power move, the paper.
He publishes. He realizes that while you can classify a machine and you can classify engineering schematics, you cannot classify the fundamental laws of physics once they are published in a peer-reviewed journal.
So he writes up the theoretical framework, the math, the Casimir connection, the broken symmetry.
And he submits it to physical review letters.
That is just genius. He weaponizes open science to protect them.
He does. Now, he leaves out the recipe, this specific temperature and voltage settings Vanessa figured out, so nobody can build a missile in their garage tomorrow. But he makes the core knowledge public property. He forces the government's hand.
Which leads directly to the Senate hearing. The transcripts of this scene are incredibly tense. He's sitting there in front of Senator Keller, who is clearly allied with Vanguard Strategic.
It is a masterclass in technically telling the truth while hiding everything that actually matters. Senator Keller is trying to trap him on the record. He asks point blank, Dr. Seaton, have you built a reactionless drive?
And Nate is walking this razor's edge.
He parses his words like a lawyer, or rather like a physicist. He admits the theory is his. He says, Senator, the equations are public domain. But when pushed on the hardware, he hides behind the theoretical nature of the paper.
Right. He denies the existence of a prototype in the specific context of the question.
Exactly. All while standing technically 3 miles away from a fully fueled nuclear spacecraft.
It buys them time, but not much time, because we are now at the precipice. The current state of affairs brings us to the very edge of the timeline in our source material.
The team is in the hangar, Skylark is built and integrated, the nuclear reactor is online, the date is set.
And Vanguard is right behind them, the Condor is being prepped at Groom Lake. We have two ships, two completely different philosophies, aiming for the exact same patch of orbit.
And there is this lingering idea right at the end of the documents from the theorist, Anya Patel. She calls it the doorway concept.
This is the part that really changes the scope of everything.
It keeps me up at night. She points out that if you can couple to the quantum vacuum to get momentum to push against it, you can theoretically couple to it to extract energy.
Zero point energy.
Yes. The vacuum isn't empty. It is seething with infinite potential. If this S-film technology is a key, it doesn't just unlock space travel. It unlocks infinite clean energy.
No more oil, no more solar grids, no more batteries. Just drawing power directly from the vacuum of space-time.
Which raises the stakes from who gets to orbit first to who controls the future of human civilization entirely. If Vanguard controls this, they don't just have a fast-armed ship. They have the ultimate economic monopoly. They hold the patent on the future of energy.
But if Nate's team succeeds and if they keep the science open, they might break the energy scarcity cycle permanently for everyone. So what does this all mean for you listening to this? Why should you care about a tiny copper film in a Portland lab?
Because it reminds us that the threshold between impossible and engineering is much thinner than we think. We assume we know the rules of the game, how gravity works, how energy works. But all it took was one mistake, one impure batch of copper, to completely rewrite the rulebook.
And it reminds us that innovation doesn't always come from the giant defense labs with the blank checks. Sometimes it comes from the guy in the flannel shirt who refuses to go home until he understands exactly why a pendulum hit the glass.
That grinder mentality. Yeah. It really is the driving force of human discovery.
So here is a final thought for you to mull over as we leave you today. The Skylark is fueled. The Condor is armed. The countdown has effectively started.
The question isn't just will they fly. The real question is, what happens when the rest of the world looks up and sees two new stars in the sky, moving in ways that shouldn't be physically possible?
That is definitely something to chew on. This has been the deep dive into the Skylark threshold. We will be watching the sky. Thanks for listening.